Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday, the 11th of June. What a week it's been. I've been busy, Kev, this week. I was in Madrid, and I'll be honest with you, I never thought I would go to Spain and it have grimmer, more miserable weather than the UK. It rained the entire 48 hours I was there, mate. It was horrific.
Well, there you go. The weather's exceptionally good in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was, most of the week, I was on the Mediterranean coast. We went up there to check on the villa, and the weather wasn't that brilliant, 25, 26.
Do you think the weather's changing around? I mean, we know it is, global warming, but do you genuinely think that it's just becoming a lot more unsettled and a lot more unpredictable? Because it just certainly feels like it. And even the Spaniards I met were like, this is really not normal weather, and we've had wall-to-wall sunshine. In fact, I think they said in January that they recorded 30 degrees in the north, which is just madness.
Yeah, yesterday Emma said to me she had a few drops of rain on her head. So, you know, for it to rain in the first few days of June, even on the north coast of Egypt, is a bit strange, really. It's unusual. So, yeah, we're having difficulties.
Yeah. Rishi in Washington meeting Biden. I mean, I don't know if you saw some of the photos. My cringiness cringed. It was basically
the cringe monitor
went up to a number 11 and basically attended the Washington National versus Arizona Diamondbacks baseball game in the U.S. Capitol. But he declined, and this is the important bit for me, he declined to throw the ceremonial first pitch, and after the UK and US anthems were played by a military band, said to the Nats manager Dave Martinez, "They should put a cricket bat in my hand. That's more my thing." I mean, way to go, Rishi, comparing an apparently unknown sport of cricket in the US to one of their most beloved sports, all because you couldn't be arsed to pitch winning over the Americans there.
Well, he had his position, didn't he?
Yeah. But, I mean, at least they announced this Atlantic Declaration. Did you see that? They unveiled it, aimed at strengthening the economic cooperation. The agreement falls short of a full trade deal, but includes provisions for UK electric car firms to access US green tax credits and subsidies. The declaration also addresses trade barriers, defence industry ties, data protection and cooperation on AI, which is obviously a big thing at the moment. And it seems like the UK is leading the drive on AI safety summit. So what did you make of that agreement or declaration?
I didn't read a lot about it, to be honest, just the headlines, as you've said. So it's not right for me to comment because I haven't really read any of the details. But I mean, it's a good first move, I think, the fact that it's moving forward. Was it a case of they were meeting together and they had to say that something was happening? I don't know. Maybe that's just me being...
I think at least Biden's starting to remember his name, because remember when he first met him, Biden managed to call him Rashi Sanook. So that right. Getting his team right now. But yeah, I mean, there were efforts to improve supply chain resilience, and also the key one was limit Russia's influence in the global civil nuclear market intensified. And that leads us on to Russia-Ukraine. I mean, just when you think things can't get much worse in Ukraine, we saw the destruction of the huge dam in the Russia-controlled area of southern Ukraine on Tuesday. The flooding in Ukraine's fertile areas is causing immediate humanitarian consequences and displacing civilians. You just can't get your head around that, can you? I mean, you know, you've got Ukraine blaming Russia, Russia blaming Ukraine. I mean, it's just beggars belief.
No, it's a tragedy. Absolute tragedy. I haven't got any more words for it.
Yeah.
There's no way that the Ukrainian people would do that to themselves. It's just bizarre.
It doesn't compute. No.
So yeah, I think they're losing, and they're going for desperate measures now. And this is going to be humanitarian disaster. Obviously, many people have died as well.
Yeah.
But many people have had their lives and houses and everyone else completely ruined for the rest of their lives. So, you know,
and the tragic part of this is you've got the landmines which were put in place have now been washed out from the land and are now floating in the towns and cities, which is just an absolute disaster. Yeah. they knew where they were before, and obviously now they have no idea where those mines are floating. So yeah, there's a lot worse to come. And then they, of course, you've got the worry of the waters from the rivers and the dam, what we use to control heat, control the basically the cooling at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, and that's a concern. Is if they can't maintain those temperatures, then you're going to get some sort of meltdown. So I mean, there was also announced on Friday an attack on the Russian city 110 miles over the border. So I think it's starting to see Putin on the back foot now, and when he's getting attacks in Moscow and actually it onto 110 miles into Russian territory, it's getting bad for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely, the whole thing is a mess.
In New York, did you see that intense wildfires in Canada and the sort of orange effect that New York was basically covered in this smoke, this smog, and it caused a lot of residents to evacuate. Quebec's worst fire season on record. New York governor emphasized the situation is temporary, not related to COVID-19. But there was obviously in New York, it affected something that, in fact, we actually went to see the performance, didn't we, of Prima Facie when we were there. But Jodie Comer, the actress, halted the Broadway show. She abruptly walked off stage during the performance on Wednesday. She had trouble breathing due to this wildfire smoke. Yeah, it was tragic, really. But I mean, did you see that in the news at all?
Yeah, I did. I saw that she up. I found it was a tremendous play. Very talented actress. But to have something floating down from Canada like that must just mean there's huge amounts of fires. Huge.
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because we were there and I kind of dragged you along, but I didn't know what it was about. I'd heard very good reports, and I think you'd agree with me that it was outstanding for one woman holding the audience for what was about 90 minutes. So many words. Didn't get one word wrong, did she? Nothing out of place. Completely flawless. So if you do go to New York City, you've got to catch Prima Facie if it's the only thing you do.
Yeah, it's well worth a watch. And I'm sure I'll come back to the UK as well.
Sure. So I think we should go on to this week's guest. We're joined today by Sapan Guy, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome back, Sapan. Enjoying this nice weather. It certainly feels like summer's finally here.
Yeah, the weather's great. We had a great RNS out this week. The only thing that could make it better is if India weren't so bad at the Oval right now.
I was going to say, why are you recording this now when you should be at the cricket?
Too busy, mate. Too busy. I was thinking about going tomorrow, but I think it will be over by the end of the day.
They've got, what was it, something like 200 behind with 4 wickets left in the first innings, was it?
Yeah. It's not great.
Very good.
I mean, you just alluded then, there was obviously a great RNS in the week which talked about positive results from downstream test work on Casillas graphite co-product. But before we delve too deep into that, do you want to just give the listeners a background into Sovereign Metals, a sort of, just give an overview of really what the company does, please?
Yeah, sure. So Sovereign Metals is developing the Casilla rutile graphite deposit, which is in Malawi. We have been in Malawi for the best part of 12 years or so. The company was originally looking for graphite-only deposits and found 3 or 4 of them, including one, the Malingundi graphite deposit, which we took all the way through to PFS, and we're working on the BFS or the definitive feasibility study, where we realized we were getting a lot of titanium out the back end of processing some of the bulk samples. So we started asking the questions, why are we seeing titanium in this graphite deposit, right? So what that led to is us basically tripping over the largest rutile deposit in the world. What is rutile? Rutile is the highest grade natural form of titanium that occurs outside of just hard rock titanium. It's around 96% titanium dioxide. Titanium dioxide is then used in a plethora of industries, including pigments, paints, plastics. It's used to obviously make titanium metal, which then goes into medical applications, military applications, aerospace applications, etc. And it's used in the welding industry, which then has obviously a knock-on effect on infrastructure, building, construction, and all the rest of it. So it's very much from that you'd expect it to be called a critical material. What is titanium? Yes, it is a critical material. The nice thing about this deposit, or the real kicker, is alongside this rutile mineralization, within the same ore body sits graphite. So we actually have a fair chunk of graphite. When I say a fair chunk, what I mean is this is the world's largest rutile deposit, but it's also the second largest flake graphite deposit in the world. And that graphite, you know, we just mentioned that announcement this week, that graphite is amenable, very suitable, and in fact, outperforms some of the benchmarks for it to be used in lithium-ion batteries. So look, where are we headed? We have, in the last 3-4 years since discovery, we've figured out just how big this thing is. Imagine 1.5 cities of Manchester. That's how big this thing is. It's huge. We've tried to figure out, is the rutile a saleable product? Everything says, yes, it is. There's no nasties, no dirties in there. The same stuff with the graphite. Is it usable in batteries? And that's what the announcement this week was about. And then we've done some initial engineering studies to figure out the economics of this thing, right? So on a very, very loose basis, we did what's known as a scoping study, and then we enhanced that given a larger resource, and we put out what's known as an enhanced or expanded scoping study around this time last year. And what that said was, if you're going to mine 30% of this deposit for 25 years, putting through 24 million tons of the material through a plant, that's going to cost you about $370 million to build. The net value, present value of that project is $1.5 billion. And just to put it into perspective about that, this project, those numbers would only mine about 30% of the deposit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the demonstration there is that you've proven now that the graphite has this excellent sustainability, so it can be used in lithium-ion batteries. I think the purity was something crazy, like greater than 99.95%. So it's almost as close to 100% purity with no critical impurities there. So is that's proof now that can be used to provide the growing lithium-ion battery anode market, right?
So look, all graphite is equal, but some graphite is more equal than others. Right? There's the graphite, you find it in hard rock, or you find it in soft friable material, as we have here, which we call saprolite. It's basically, at a particle level, it's they're hexagonal particles, right? And they need to be able to undergo certain chemical methods in order to end up as anode material. The first of those is you have to be able to purify it up to 99.95%. So any graphite that can't reach that purity level, that benchmark level, really doesn't work well within batteries, right? The test work showed that ours does very easily. Secondly, it needs to be able to be spheronized, which is a nice term for saying those flakes, those hexagonal flakes, get milled together to a point where they start folding on each other and creating little spheres, little balls. And we're doing the test work at the Cassia project to see whether that is the case with ours. The nice thing, or the legacy knowledge that we have, is this graphite is almost identical to the graphite at our old Malingundi deposit. And we have done the spheronization purification test work at the Malingundi deposit, would you believe it, in 2016, 17, when no one was talking about lithium-ion batteries and all the rest of it, but we had already done that test work. So we're very confident that the Cassia graphite will likely act the same in the same conditions. Then you've got to coat it, which is a chemical method where those spheres of graphite get coated, and then they get laid out into a material that ends up in the batteries, that specific anode manufacturing. Now, look, we're explorers and developers. We're going to stick to our knitting. So we're not going to start looking at building gigafactories or anything like that in anytime soon. You know, someone asked me the other day, what does this mean about Sovereign looking downstream? And I said, just because you're the best chicken farmer in the world doesn't mean you know the Colonel's secret recipe, right? So we're going to do what we know and what our knowledge base is all about. This graphite is most likely going to end up in lithium-ion batteries.
So you've got, I mean, obviously, would it be safe to say that there's any number of companies who are crying out for you know, battery-grade graphite? Because obviously in the past you've announced onto the rutile side of things that you've got offtakes in place with, I think it was Chemours for 20,000 tons of natural rutile per annum from Cassia. and also with the Mitsui as well, as you just alluded to earlier on. So would it be safe to say that there's potential there for offtakes with other companies for the graphite element?
It's interesting you mentioned Mitsui, because the Japanese have been moving very fast in the critical minerals, the battery mineral space. I think they put together a $24 billion fund to go and secure the battery minerals. You know, there's certain economies which talk about doing this stuff and love to sign treaties and mention what's a critical mineral to them. And then there's other economies who just go out there and start doing it. And I think you've seen with the Japanese and the way they've acted in the past with the electronics boom, with the automotive industry, they're the type of economy that just goes on and gets stuff done. So even though our alliance, our MOU with Mitsui is based around the rutile, I have no doubt that some of their own customers, if not them themselves, will be interested in the graphite.
The scenario then is you have the world's biggest rutile deposit. You have a situation now where you have a lot of graphite. That's right. Yes. I mean, it's not like a small amount of graphite.
24 million tons of graphite. And just to put it into perspective, right, we're still going, this is natural graphite, the graphite that is mined, not graphite which is created from recrystallizing petroleum, coke, and using oil and all the stuff that the Chinese do to make the battery, to make the anode material that currently ends up in your Tesla and other electric vehicles, right? So it's natural graphite. And the easiest way to think about it is if you look at the demand from, you know, certain market players, to 2018, we were talking total graphite demand of about 250,000 tons per annum. Fast forward to last year, that demand was over 1 million tons per annum. The biggest contributing factor to that increase in demand was lithium ion batteries, were essentially electrification of the vehicle fleet. On the same trajectory, we're thinking, or you know, market players are thinking, cumulative annual growth rate of around 25 to 30% per annum. So you're talking about 4 million tons of demand by 2030, right? So actually, it's a lot of graphite, but if all the graphite miners, developers, all came online tomorrow, were able to use all that graphite in lithium-ion batteries, neither of those is the case, of course, there'd still be a requirement for synthetic graphite, i.e. the demand will always outstrip the supply. We're looking at a supply deficit in the graphite market in 2025, which is not too far away.
Yeah, so you've got a huge amount of graphite, as you say, 24 million tons. I mean, that obviously you're not going to mine 1 million tons a year of graphite, I wouldn't imagine. Anyway, based on what you just said about the market, it's possible, but unlikely, I think.
Our initial thinking around what we're looking to develop around Cassia, 24 million tons of the material goes in. We'll produce around 240,000 tons of rutile and about 150,000 tons of graphite.
Okay, per annum.
Per annum.
Okay, so 150,000 tons of rutile of graphite. So your market cap at the minute at 110 million pounds. How does that sit with either project? Let's say you only had one of either project. How does it correspond to this market cap?
I think that's just look at that NPV number that I talked about earlier of $1.5 billion versus, you know, the market cap in US dollars today, what 130. And of course, you wouldn't expect us to have that $1.5 billion kind of valuation until the point where we have de-risked everything, we have built everything, and we're about to switch this thing on, right? But we have done a lot of work and enough work, in my opinion, to get us closer to that $1.5 billion than we are right now.
I mean, the reality of the situation is that I think a lot of these players, obviously including yourselves, are seriously undervalued because of the finance side of things in terms of that. Now, you have said in previous RNSs that certainly, and you just referenced it about the Japanese company, can you see that any of your partners will come in with you in terms of financing to help you to guarantee this resource? Because everyone's scrambling for this resource. And as you say, the UK, the US government's talking about it. I think the US are doing more than the UK governments, that's for sure, because they're actually putting some money where their mouth is. But can you see that there's going to be literally a plethora of people want to help fund this?
Yeah, look, the first thing I'd say is we described Kaseya a number of times as tier one, as world class, you know, once in a lifetime find. There hasn't been a rutile deposit found of this magnitude for 50, 60, 70 years. Second largest graphite deposit. When I say all those things, in the minds of many people, they're thinking this is going to cost billions to build. And the reality is, the numbers that we looked at, our CapEx would be below $400 million for a $1.5 billion return. So we're talking about 3-to-1 ratio in terms of your return on investment at the point of putting in the capital expenditure. So actually, it's not one of these projects that requires billions to get off the ground. Now, of course, with my old investment banking hat on, I'm always looking at, you know, where do we go in terms of financing in order to develop this project? And I would love to use as many different ways and means which don't dilute our shareholders, including ourselves. You know, management holds around 15% of the company. We want to use the lowest capital cost ways and means. So things like working with potential partners, you know, strategic partners, or looking at off-takers like the Japanese that you mentioned. You know, in the past, especially in some of the other bulk industries such as iron ore, you do see the trading houses come in and, you know, they'll say, okay, for X percent of offtake, we'll provide you with that same percentage of the value of the project. And that usually then funds quite a decent chunk of your CapEx. So any of those solutions are all on the table now, and we're looking at all of them at that moment.
Very good. And I mean, we have come at a time in the market, probably the last 2 years, probably the worst time living memory for resource sector plays. Ultimately, people just not believing that these resources are there. So I just ask you a question. It's definitely there. Like Malawi, the rutile, the graphite.
Malawi's definitely there.
Yes, there.
And the rutile's definitely there.
The graphite's definitely there.
What I'll do for you, Kevin, is over the coming days and weeks, I'll start posting a whole bunch of videos and photos, and you can see exactly what we've got. And I'll do that on our LinkedIn feed.
Even the president of Malawi acknowledges that Kaseya's there as well, didn't he?
Well, you mentioned it at the UN General Assembly last year, so you know, it's definitely there.
I mean, just one other thing is, because obviously we've talked very much about the kind of the low cost operation here, and I think it's important for the listeners to understand is that this soft friable high grade mineralization with the talking about the rutile in particular is that can be actually hydro mined. Do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about how easy it is to get this product out of the ground, or not even off the ground, but you know, how to mine it really?
Yeah, so we've been blessed with a couple of things. Number one, that, you know, what we call soft friable material. Just imagine, looks like rock in your hands, but as soon as you turn your hand into a fist, it all crumbles. It crumbles like a cake, right? That's the kind of material this is. This isn't hard rock mining. It isn't where you need explosives to drill into the hard rock, blast the hard rock, and then you have to put it into big, huge trucks and truck it over somewhere else where it gets crushed and ground down until it can finally end up in a processing plant. This stuff, we're looking at hydro mining, as you said. That's using, for lack of a better phrase, a very high-powered water jet, which is just targeted at the material. The material and the water combine, that all flows down through pipes into the processing plant. It's really that simple. The other thing we've been blessed with is it's in Malawi, so you get a lot of sunshine. So a lot of our power solution is around solar energy. So what we're trying to do essentially is trying to make this one of the, if not the lowest CO2 footprint graphite and rutile projects in the world. And just to give you a bit of context to that synthetic graphite I talked about earlier, to make a ton of that, the Chinese are putting out 20 tons of CO2 emissions. And then that ton of synthetic graphite can then end up in your electric vehicle to save the planet. We are looking at a carbon footprint on the graphite out of Kaseya at 0.2 tons. That's 1%, right? That's a 99% saving on your CO2 emissions or your greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah. If you were to use this graphite in your electric vehicle versus what's being used currently. So, and look, we're trying to make this all sustainable, because ultimately it's only going to be the more sustainable miners, the more eco-friendly miners, the more environmentally and socially responsible miners who are going to, in, you know, 12, 24, 36 months from now, they're the ones who are going to get the funding to be built. They're also going to be the ones who are at the top of the list when it comes to security of supply for the big end users.
Yeah, I mean, Cassia's graphite element is not only the second largest in the world, I guess the global warming potential is to be among the lowest in the world as well, right?
Yeah. And again, even on the rutile, we've done a similar work to see what, and these are called life cycle assessments. So from the point that the rutile is in the ground to the point that it ends up in a tin of paint on your shelf at B&Q, what's the carbon footprint of that? And early stage, but what our life cycle assessment shows that you could save about 50% of your carbon footprint using the rutile from Cassia rather than any other titanium bearing minerals around the world.
So do you think that's going to attract actually a financial premium on the graphite or not, or on rutile or the graphite?
So it's interesting because, you know, if you're a European user of, you know, any of these materials, but let's stick to rutile. So you need titanium dioxide. You're a pigment producer in Europe, for example. We've already had numerous discussions, not us as a company, but, you know, the EU and others around carbon taxes and having to offset your carbon footprint, et cetera. So that becomes a real monetary issue for, you know, a pigment producer in Europe. And we saw, I think, maybe about 12 months ago, we were seeing that the tax or the carbon offset, the carbon border tax within the EU reached around 100 euros a ton, right? So if you put every ton of CO2, greenhouse gas emissions, you as a producer of anything in the EU are putting up your chimney stack, you're having to pay 100 euros for it. So yes, we do see that there will be a premium to the lower CO2 products going forwards.
Interesting. So it won't necessarily be more profitable for you, but your product's likely to be more in demand because of it, and because of the cost that the governments are going to impose on.
The other thing to remember is, of course, you know, every end user of any of these products currently in this world where we are looking at decarbonization, their own shareholders, their own stakeholders, you know, the countries within they operate in will want to know, what does the CO2 footprint of your supply chain look like in order for you to produce this widget or whatever they are producing, right? And that's everyone, whether it's your European institutional investor, or whether that's, you know, the permit office on the ground within the countries you operate in, they all want to know this. So the lower the footprint of your carbon footprint of your supply chain, the better, right? And people are going to be paying a premium to get to there.
So I guess moving forward, I think the company is set to release the outcomes of the project's pre-feasibility studies in the coming months. But what else do you think shareholders and listeners can look forward to in over the coming months?
Yeah, so look, everything to do around the PFS, we've already put out an upgraded resource that moved about 60% of our global resource into the indicated category, i.e. higher confidence that we understand exactly what that resource looks like and what grade the materials are at in there. We'll be doing a lot of work towards getting to the end PFS, and we'll be putting out any information around, you know, some of the engineering studies, the logistics solutions to this. We'll be doing a bit more test work. We've still got to do a lot more work on the graphite as well as the rutile. So look, in short, lots of news to come.
Very good. Well, I was just going to ask you, I mean, now the weather's getting, it does actually feel like summer is finally here in the UK. What's your Sunday meal now? You're going to get the barbecue out, or are you going to still be doing the traditional roast?
So we are blessed with a lovely little pub. Shout out The Boat in Catherine de Barnes down the bottom of our road.
He's open for a free lunch now.
Which has a beautiful beer garden. Right now, I'm just thinking about the beer amaretti there, and we can worry about the food later.
Super.
Sounds good. It's amazing what happens in these places when the sun shines, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very good. Well, we'll just say Sapan.
Dude.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Sapan.
Okay, so what about the movers and shakers of the week? I mean, last week, I believe I chose Drums as bargain of the week, and it is up 56% on that week. Drums, obviously, being the name that I used last week, they've gone through the name change to Acuity Risk Management and now go under the ticker ACRM, for those who may be a little bit confused if they have the stock and they're now not seeing it in the profile with the same name. What do you make of the performance of Drums and obviously the announcement on Friday morning about the contract win?
Yeah, another contract win moving forward. You know, I think we have to take a slightly different view with these technology stocks, because the technology stocks really should be valued or seem to be valued much higher than anything that we talk about in the resource space. So I think, you know, there's been people on the Acuity group saying that really the like for like share price from before the RTO to after the RTO is really 14p. So we're only back to square one once we hit 14p. So I still think there's a lot of movement in this. I mean, I think it finished on Friday in the nines, you know, some people paid 10, maybe it was 9.9, 9.5, something like that. So it was up 50-odd% on the week, as you said. So well done. That was a great bargain of the week.
The other thing to notice about it, and it's just worth mentioning, is, as you said, that there's a name change, and that's really important. And I'm glad they did it, because originally Drums was effectively an investment vehicle, and they had 25% investment into Acuity Risk Management. And now they've gone from being an investment vehicle into a working company, effectively. You know, with Generate, so they're 100% owned now, and that's not to say that Acuity won't make another investment in this space, and Angus has made that clear. It doesn't mean to say that they won't go into another technology company at some point, but at the moment they're focusing on the Acuity. They're working with Netitude, and this is the first contract that they've got through the Netitude partnership. Okay,
yep. So it's very good. And though it was a small contract, it was with an insurance company. There's huge scope for it to be increased in size and magnitude. And when you see that one of the insurance companies does well with this, what's likely to happen? You know, I mean, it's likely to roll out to other insurance companies as well, I think, once the thing comes. So, yep, very good results. So are you going to replace it with something? What's your shed for next week?
I think really, after talking to Sapan, I'm going to go with Sovereign Metals as bargain of the week, just because it's down at the bottom. It's around it's sort of the 23 to 25 range. It's been there for ages. They've had there was a really good RNS about the graphite and the quality of it, the purity. You know, we've seen so many of the MOUs for the rutile, and I just think the market simply hasn't woken up to the fact. The numbers on this one, when you look at the operating costs and the NPV and all those numbers, it just stacks up.
Yeah, I mean, over the last year, it hasn't really been much lower than this.
But it's been a lot higher, hasn't it? It's been in the 45 to 50 range.
Yeah, it was very briefly after the news came out, didn't it, of the surveys that they did, and then it then came back down again, and then hung around 30s, I think, for quite a while, and then has just fallen back down, probably due to lack of interest.
Yeah,
just because there wasn't much happening. So I think any sort of volume on this is going to move it. And I agree with you. Having listened to Sapa, and I think it's way too cheap at the moment. It's way too cheap. I mean, if any of those things happen that he's talking about, that they get the finance sorted out with some sort of offtake agreement or some sort of scenario, then it'll fly. I mean, it really will. It'll be in the pounds. It won't be 20-odd p, I think, is the reality. What else has been happening?
Genflow had a good week. They were up about 24-25% around the 3p mark. Had a bit of a movement, a bit more volume came in. So that was...
Yeah, I think there's been a bit of a seller in that one. I don't know, since it went up to 5p, there's been one of the big sellers wanting out of their position. And, you know, I think that's going to start coming to an end as well. So that could do well as well. If you remember, we had that one as stock of the week for a while back, and it did very well.
Yep.
And then it came back down again because of the seller, I think. But I think the seller's going to be out shortly. So, or it seems that way anyway, because it's went down to 2.4, I think it was, and then had an attempt on the 3P again, and then came back down again, and then went back up again. So I think,
Yeah, it swings quite wildly, that one. And I do think good things will come, especially with the US side of things and the listing. So Amigo was an interesting one. I don't know if you saw the announcement on Friday. Again, it just beggars belief. It's up 150% on the day. And basically, Amigo Holdings, they commenced an orderly solvent wind down of its business after an unsuccessful capital raise process. So why people, I'll tell you why people piled into it on Friday, because the company announced that they'd entered into an exclusivity agreement with Michael Fleming, a financier and shareholder, to explore debt investment options for the company or its subsidiaries. The exclusivity period expires on the 6th of September, and interested parties for debt investment can contact investors at amigo.me. So it's just all hinging on whether or not this investment option can come in from this Michael Fleming, really. So massive punt, but obviously people like the news that there was a lifeline for it, and it bounced 150% on Friday.
Yep. And another bouncer this week was Jubilee Metals, which should be bouncing a hell of a lot higher than it already is as well, but it was up 20-odd% this week, I think. So again, you're going to be a huge producer of copper from tailings, and a huge producer of platinum already, and the platinum group of metals and chrome. You know, I mean, it hasn't stopped producing all of this time, and yet the share price has just continued to slide. So that one, I mean, I've got a few that I like at the minute that I think are going to have things to give them an impetus. You've got Prospect Energy, which I think has, you know, first gas coming very shortly, and is going to have a good run, I think, again. It was up at 20-odd P, now it's at 8P. You know, it's overdone on the downside, just like it probably was overdone on the upside. You've got Teck Minerals, which is coming shortly as well, when they turn on the machines and start doing those lithium-ion batteries or recycling the lithium-ion batteries. You got Chill Brands as well, who have now launched in the US their vapes. They're about to launch them in the UK with the 1,500 and 3,000 puffs. Again, it's going to be a catalyst for more and more revenue coming for that one. What else can we think of? I think that there is quite a few under the radar. The Golden Metal Resources this week had a good RNS as well. Very interesting about the gold and the type of gold that is relevant just to Nevada. Again, one that I think could do very well. And obviously that's well connected with Power Metal Resources as well. So yeah, there's a lot of things moving. And I think someone said it to me today. It seems to be that things are moving and actually hopefully staying where they're moving to, which is you know, a really positive sign that we're getting somewhere, that things are moving up and then hopefully starting to stay up, because people are starting to realize, hey, I could be onto a winner here, you know?
Yeah. I saw the news on, I think it was news on Friday as well, just while you're on the subject of gold and metal resources, that they had the mega company up their position in the company from like 3.5% to about 4.4%. So that was welcome to see. And as you say, they had great news about the Pilot Mountain project. There was some survey uncovered three significant exploration targets. So that one looks really, really interesting. Tungsten, copper, silver, zinc mineralization. Yeah. So very, very good, that one. That looks very interesting. And it's still around the IPO price, right? It's around the 8p mark.
If IPO price was 8.5p, so yeah, it's not even at that yet. Yeah. No, I was speaking briefly with Oliver during the week, actually, because we'd interviewed him a few weeks back. And the tungsten, if you remember during that interview, we talked about one of the places had most of the tungsten. And now the other three places are obviously look like they could be very prospective. But that obviously is going to be one of the critical metals for the US as well. So hopefully the way that the loans and stuff work in the US, it could be very beneficial for the company. But also the gold in Nevada that I mentioned as well, that they have had some sort of, I don't remember the name he talked about in terms of how they find this type of gold. But interesting stuff. Yeah, I think we're moving in the right direction. But nobody wants to be too positive just yet, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, we talk about a little bit about the wider markets. I mean, things like Bitcoin have suffered in the last week or so. I think after the Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC, basically launched legal action against the first crypto exchange, Binance, and then the US-based rival Coinbase. So it obviously knocked a lot of confidence in there. They think the premise that if you hold it within one of those companies, you could potentially lose a lot of it. So it suffered on that. But wider markets, I mean, what else have you seen? Have you been monitoring things like the FTSE and the, you know, the S&P and the Dow, etc.? How do you think?
The dollar? They've reacted quite well. The dollar's gone back up again, which again is just bizarre in my mind. But I mean, the dollar's gone back up again. But I think it's short-term trading on the basis that they think the US may well raise rates again, but at the same time, they're probably not going to in June. Yeah. You're seeing gold fall off again a little bit from its highs of over 2000, but now sticking around the 1950 mark for the US dollar. But actually adjusted for the dollar, it's probably at all-time highs in sterling and all the other ones. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, there's a bit of instability still there. I mean, you've even got copper that's making a bit of a comeback again, but not really moving where it should be as far as I can see. And resources in general are just so beaten up. I just don't get it really. Yeah, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah,
but the one thing that is reassuring, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, is the S&P VIX, which is basically the measurement of volatility in the stock market. Well, that is a year low. It's at 13.66. And if you remember before, we've talked about this when it's been 20, 30, it hit 35 at one point this year. And now it's at a low for the year of 13.65. Now, what does that say? That just means that there's unlikely to be huge volatility in the market. Can change at any point, obviously. But, you know, during the COVID crisis and all the other problems that we had, we were at 50, 60, 70 on the VIX, and it was going mental.
Yeah.
And now we're basically at a low, over a multi-year low almost at this sort of level. So should that bring some optimism? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But all of these things are factoring in. Still think the dollar's going to drop off. Not necessarily off a cliff, but it's going to drop off. I think we're going to see gold go on another run because people are going to be like, oh, yeah. Gold is a good holder of wealth, especially during inflation. So, yeah. But I think we're going to have a good second half of the year in stocks. That's my view.
Yeah.
We've been waiting a long time. And I know you've kept saying to me, oh, it's not coming yet. It's not coming yet. But we're seeing it. We're seeing it. And we're seeing it in a few more stocks than we did before. So let's hope.
It certainly feels a bit more optimistic. But I mean, while we're on the subject of the interest rates, obviously one of the knock-on effects of high interest rates is we've actually seen an announcement this week. I've actually got the paper in front of me. I was reading it last night. And basically it states that UK house prices have experienced their first annual fall in 11 years with a decrease of 1% compared to the previous year. The decline is seen as the beginning of a correction in house prices triggered by rising mortgage rates. Housing analysts predict a potential correction of 10 to 15%, but do not anticipate any kind of crash. Recent inflation figures have led to an increase in fixed rate mortgage rates impacting affordability. Lending to first time buyers and home movers has decreased, and there is a shift towards downsizing. These rising mortgage rates may lead to more people selling their properties, including second homes and buy-to-let properties. There is also a risk of forced selling, which could obviously potentially trigger a future market crash. More than 100,000 households are due to come to the end of their fixed rate deals this month. I actually saw a tweet this morning. Someone put a screenshot from their letter that they received saying you're currently on the rate of 2.29% and you're going on to a rate of 7.74%. Ouch. So HSBC has pulled all its mortgages, record numbers to take out loans of more than 35 years in an attempt to make the monthly payments more affordable. And then there's a further 640,000 homeowners have deals that come to an end in the second half of this year. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think it's due a correction?
Yeah, it's due a correction for sure. I think it's not going to be a sell down correction, but I think we're going to have a correction. I think if you read that out in a year's time, it will say house prices have dropped between probably 6 and 8%,
yeah,
across the board. I think one of the points that I read on one of the online things was that because the government is starting to change this tenancy situation and give the tenant a lot more rights instead of the landlord, especially in the no-fault eviction, that a lot of people with one or two sort of houses that they've got rented out don't want this anymore.
Yeah.
And they're basically saying, okay, I'm selling up.
Selling up, yeah, because it's, And also with the change in tenancy rules, isn't it? You know, as a renter, you've got more rights than the landlord, effectively. You know, yeah. they can't. There was rules, wasn't there, during the pandemic where they said that if you don't pay your rent, they can't be evicted. So the odds are heavily stacked against the landlord in a lot of these rental cases. Yeah. But one of the interesting things, and this is just the irony of it, is that many of those that rush to buy properties to take advantage of the COVID stamp duty holiday are the ones that are coming to a close and that are facing renewals. They're on the 2021 to 23, 2 years around March, April. You know, they're coming to a close now. So, you know, they rushed out to do this to get around this, the stamp duty, you know, basically the wave stamp duty, didn't they? So that increased at a false market during those times, didn't it? Because people weren't selling the houses. Then all of a sudden, Rishi, it wasn't Rishi at the time, they announced the, you know, basically no stamp duty. Massive amount of houses came on, you know, were sold and bought, and we had a kind of a bit of a false increase in the prices because of that. And now, unfortunately, they're the ones that they're going to have to remortgage on these higher rates. I mean, what do you do? Do you sell up? Do you go on a higher rate and forced into a 5.5% one? I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the
option. Well, a lot of those people must be close to the. Close to the bone in terms of how much they can borrow as well, especially if they overreached when they were buying it. So, yeah. And I think all of these factors are going to come into play in the next couple of years. And some people are going to find themselves in difficult positions and they're going to have to make difficult decisions. So that's what will cause the more properties to come on the market, I think. And then obviously in a situation where there's more properties, there's going to be a reduction in the price. I think people are going to be able to bargain on. They're going to be able to discuss the price rather than start looking to see who's going to gazump them. I think those days are gone for the next few years anyway. We will see.
So on to something a bit more lighthearted, football. Obviously, yeah. United. I watched the game last week, the FA Cup final. I thought we put on a relatively good performance against a much, much stronger team. City were, you know, we got a lucky penalty awarded for sure. But ultimately, we put on a game and I was quite happy. I didn't expect to go out of it with a trophy, but fair play. And it was a good game to watch. I enjoyed it, to be honest.
Yeah, just that boy is a diving cheat. Captain or not of Manchester United, Fernandez,
yeah,
I do not like you. You are a cheat.
But this wasn't that wasn't the decision, was it? If you watch the game, it was all down to the old Grealish raising, coming down, and his arm being in the air. It's a difficult one, really. But anyway, he was very aggrieved. But they won in the end, and they got the trophy. So. Also want to say congratulations to West Ham. I was actually there
last night
and I watched all the fans rushing in and they were all proper. It was great to see, to be fair.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Good for Declan Rice. Yeah, looks like he's going to move on. Who's going to buy him? Is he off to United for 100 million? Who knows?
Who knows?
Or maybe even City just to sit on the bench for 100 million? Who knows?
Is he off to Saudi?
He's not off to Saudi, but the interesting thing is Benzema's taking the cash, so Benzema's off.
248 million or something like that, I read it roughly.
I don't know. And Messi's not taking the cash, even though he's not getting paid into Miami or wherever they call themselves, but he's decided he doesn't want to go and live in Saudi Arabia with his family and get paid literally hundreds and hundreds of millions. Maybe billions.
Messi
gets
25 million just for being a, you know, like an advocate for being beating the drum of Saudi anyway. So
Yes. So he didn't need to go for any more. So he's going to be with Mr. Beckham, isn't he?
Yeah.
And they also sacked Neville, wasn't it? Phil Neville. They sacked Phil Neville as the manager. So the old boys network's been split up there in terms of the manager. So we'll see who he brings in. It might be quite interesting.
An awkward conversation.
Yeah. By the way, Phil, you're fired.
Yeah.
By the way, Phil, you fired me.
So, what about the other news? There was
the Live PGA.
Yeah, that looks.
That was shocking. Your man Jay Monahan, who's the lead character in the PGA. Now, this is the PGA Tour, not the PGA of America. Because if we all think back 60 years ago, Mr. Nicholas and the boys all clubbed together and jumped ship from the PGA of America to form the PGA Tour because they weren't getting paid enough. What did the Live boys do? Exactly the same. They joined, and yes, they used Saudi Arabia money by the PIF fund. And now the PGA Tour has said, we'll join you. And basically everyone's saying that Saudi Arabia has bought men's golf around the world. And effectively, they have bought the influence of men's golf all around the world. This is a fact. How it'll all play out and who will be upset and who will not be upset and da-da-da-da, I don't know. But I've been watching the LIV Golf every tournament, pretty much. It's incredibly enjoyable. It's very interesting. Each round's over in the four and a half hours. You don't have to sit there for 12 hours, 13 hours to watch everybody play because it's a shotgun start. So I think it's the way things are going.
Certainly.
So very, very interesting. But
makes it more exciting for sure.
Yeah. How Jay Monahan has done this and he's still going to be in his position, I find it incredible. I really do, because he has called the Saudis and LIV all the names under the sun, and now he's in business with them. It's bizarre.
Okay. Well, just thinking about investments, and what I was thinking was, if any listeners want to get in touch with us and offer us, something that they're interested in, or you know, stock that we've maybe not covered in the past, with interview the CEO, or put a case out for an investment, and we'll have a look at it, then please just send us a message, whether it be written or even spoken, and if it's an audio message, maybe we could include it on the show one week as one of our listeners' stocks, and then we could potentially engage with the company and bring the CEO on board. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a good idea. A couple of people spoke to me on Telegram about different companies. We will offer any company an initial interview, okay? So, you know, we are not, I mean, some of the groups have been asking me to write, is it paid, is it not paid? Any company can come onto the roast and it's not paid.
It's a free tool platform, like, exactly.
It's
that.
Free.
It's no cost to come on any of the roasts.
But we then will take a PR contract with people if they wish us to do the PR. But the actual podcast itself, initially, there is no cost. So, yeah. If you've got anything that you think's gonna do very, very well, let us know. Yeah. We like to tell the story. I mean, yes, we have numerous customers as PR, but at the same time, when we first started this whole process, it was to give a different view to the retail investor about stocks by interviewing the CEO. And that's it.
All right. Well, just want to say thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in the week with more material.
Yep, indeed. Don't forget, we're on YouTube as well, and you can get us on Audioboom and all the other listening device things that are out.
Hit like and subscribe.
Yep. If you can like and subscribe YouTube, that'd be great. Gives us an idea who's listening. Okay, guys.
Good.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.